and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Today we have a sermon by Matt Carlson.
So last week, you'll remember that Jennifer helped set the stage for the story of Sarai and Abram. She recited the story of Abram, who heard the voice of the Lord to leave his country, his kindred, and his father's house to go to a land the Lord would show him. You may recall, too, the map that we had here, the map that was shown marking the stages of Sarai and Abram's journey. First with Abram's father and family from Ur to Haran, then along with Sarai and Lot, his nephew, to Canaan. They departed Canaan because of famine and then traveled to Egypt. The Pharaoh eventually expelled them from Egypt because of Abram's deception, passing off Sarai as his sister out of fear for his own life, so that she was taken into the Pharaoh's house. Abram, Sarai, Lot, and all of Abram's possessions then traveled through the Negev to Bethel. It was here that Abram and Lot parted ways, after which Abram and Sarai settled back in Canaan. The part of the story we are now going to explore happens 10 years after Sarai and Abram settle in the land of Canaan. But before we move there, a couple more thoughts. First, I want to examine the command and the promise. When Abram hears the voice of the Lord calling him on his journey to a new land, it is a command that requires Abram to cut all ties to his identity as a man in the patriarchal system of his ancient world, taking him from his land, his family, and his father's house. In his culture, Abram is essentially giving up his past and his present to heed the Lord's imperative. After the command to go, the Lord promises to make of Abram a great nation, blessing those who bless him and cursing those who despise him. The word blessing occurs 5 times in the promise, as opposed to the 1 utterance of a curse. Yet the promise is ambiguous and may have raised questions for Abram. Perhaps the most pressing and acute ambiguity for Abram was caused by the simple reality that he had no child, no heir. Without a child, there could be no nation, no great name, no blessing. This brings me to my second thought. Even though the promise has been given to Abram, and it would be his name venerated among the families of the earth, it all hinges on Sarai. Just before Abram receives his word from the Lord, the text tells us that Sarai was barren. She had no child. While Abram is called to give up his past and his present, the condition of Sarai's barrenness risks their future. And while much of the emphasis is placed on Abram in the overall story and in subsequent interpretations of the story, including in the songs we teach our children, Father Abraham had many sons. Even though the emphasis is on Abram, the role of Sarai in the fulfillment of the promise deserves attention. And, as we'll see, the story of Hagar sheds light on the character of the divine. Let's look at the main characters in this story. As Phyllis Tribble points out, the opening verse of chapter 16, "And Sarai, Abram's wife, bore him no children. She had an Egyptian slave girl whose name was Hagar." This verse in Hebrew reverses the usual word order and is written with the subject, Sarai, before the verb, placing her at the beginning of the sentence. The name of Hagar, Sarai's handmaid, doesn't appear until the very end of the phrase, perhaps foreshadowing syntactically the coming opposition between the two women. We are told again in this opening verse that Sarai bore no children. This is reiterated, perhaps to remind the reader that the obstacle to the promise given to Abram still persists, and to provide a motivation for Sarai's coming plan of action. The inability to conceive is portrayed in the Hebrew Scriptures as an issue for the female. Never is it suggested that Abram is impotent. And it was a common understanding that the Lord was directly involved with the opening and closing of wombs. We see that understanding here when Sarai places the responsibility on God for her infertility. It's also here that we first hear Sarai speak, and she speaks to Abram. It's interesting to note parallels between this story and the earlier story of Abram's deception. It's in the story of Abram's deception that we also hear Abram speak for the first time, and he speaks to Sarai. Abram's first words to Sarai lay out a scheme to manipulate Pharaoh and Sarai. Sarai's first words lay out a scheme to manipulate Abram and Hagar. Abram deceived Pharaoh into treating Sarai as a sexual object. Sarai persuades Abram to use Hagar as a sexual surrogate. Both plans were responses to hard realities, paths to self-preservation, and neither plan asks for the consent of the participants. It's also interesting to note that Sarai, in Canaan, treats Hagar in a similar manner to how Sarai herself was treated in Egypt, as an object to be traded and used. But perhaps it's understandable that Sarai would use Hagar in this way. The ongoing trauma of her infertility and the social pressures of being childless weigh on her. The trauma of being pimped out by her husband, and not only once. The stress from the knowledge of her own infertility in light of her husband's vision of a multitude of offspring. Sarai may have had to give up her own desire of being a mother, so she hatches this plan as a way to move forward, placing her hope in Hagar's body. Hope and imagination. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This has sometimes been interpreted that in some far-off future, things will get worked out. The text we heard from Hebrews intimates as much, later stating the reality that Sarah and Abraham died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. A different interpretation could put the responsibility on us to use our imaginations for changing things in the present, to turn our hopes into reality. In light of this, perhaps the invitation to Abram to father a child through the surrogacy of Hagar was Sarai's faithful response to God's promise. After all, up to this point, Sarai is not specifically named in the promise as the mother of Abram's offspring. Perhaps this was an imaginative response to fulfill the divine promise in light of the old age of Sarai and Abram. Granted, the practice of using slaves as surrogates was common and accepted in the ancient world. Even so, this convention provided a way forward that gave hope to the hopeless. But this is not how it turns out. If you're a fan of the Hulu show, A Handmaid's Tale, you may have a glimpse into the complexity of the relationship between an infertile wife and an unwilling surrogate slave in an overtly militaristic patriarchal system. Hagar does become pregnant, but it is not the solution Sarai may have been hoping for. Hagar ends up despising Sarai, and Sarai's position as wife is threatened by Hagar's exalted status. Hagar also becomes a constant reminder of Sarai's own barrenness. This adds another layer to Sarai's unresolved trauma. Sarai, out of her own pain, inflicts pain on Hagar, causing Hagar to flee into the wilderness. In this story, Abram plays a brief supporting role. He is a quiet pawn in Sarai's plan. His silence could be seen as acquiescence, but he could also be responding or not responding out of his own trauma. Even though he is the privileged one in a patriarchal system, he is also trapped by the system, also under pressure to produce an heir to ensure his legacy. Furthermore, he has chosen to set himself outside that system by leaving his land, his family, and his father's house. So even though he is still considered privileged within the system, he may be experiencing some confusion about his new identity. Having given up his past and his present, he is banking on his future, a future threatened by Sarai's infertility. So the potential of Sarai's plan to have a child with Hagar may have had some appeal. Could a child with Hagar be the child of promise? The text states that Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her slave girl, and gave her to her husband Abram as a wife. He went into Hagar, and she conceived. Later we know that Hagar gives birth, and the child is named Ishmael. And here's an interesting thought experiment. What if Ishmael was the child of promise? How would that have changed the story and the ensuing historical trajectory? On at least one occasion, Abram pleads with the Lord on behalf of Ishmael. "Oh, that Ishmael may live in your sight," he says. Abram loved this boy, this child in the flesh and real, not an abstract idea. Why not put their hope in him? Abram's silence in this story may also be due to secondary trauma. Throughout chapter 16, he is characterized as passive, following Sarai's plan without protest, and then choosing not to intervene when conflict between Hagar and Sarai arises. Abram has witnessed his wife's struggle with infertility, has witnessed the conflict between Sarai and Hagar. We may criticize Abram for not intervening, but his lack of response could also be understood as an inability to even know how to respond in the face of witnessing trauma endured by others, even and perhaps especially trauma that he himself inflicted. One of the amazing things with this story is that we actually get to hear the perspective of Hagar. Up to this point, her voice has been silent. The narrator names her, but Sarai herself does not name her, referring to her instead as "my slave girl." It's likely that Hagar was one of the slaves that Pharaoh gave to Abram in Egypt. As the syntax of the opening verse of chapter 16 indicates, Hagar, in contrast to Sarai, was on the lower end of the social spectrum as a poor, single, and bonded woman, in addition to being a foreigner. She was a slave in her homeland and then passed on to Abram as a slave. She had no control over her own life, no say in where she wanted to go, who she wanted to be. In the list of the gifts given to Abram from the Pharaoh, male and female slaves were positioned between male and female donkeys, an indication perhaps of their lowly estate. When Abram left Egypt, his possessions went with him, including his slaves. Trauma and powerlessness were ongoing realities for Hagar. And not only did she not have control over her own vocation or social location, she had no control over her own body. Her body was owned by her mistress and could be used in whatever way her mistress seemed fitting, even as a surrogate for her child. But here was also possible salvation. If she became the mother of the child of promise, surely her station would change. As stated before, she was given to Abram as wife. But things didn't change for Hagar after she became pregnant. They only became worse. Her contempt for infertile Sarai showed clearly. The victim becomes the victimizer, and Sarai dealt with her harshly. Hagar's station in the family, lowly as it was no longer secure. So, despite being unprepared, she flees to the wilderness. And it's here in the wilderness that Hagar's status does change, not among the people of Abram, but among those who read her story now. An angel of the Lord, the Lord's self,
visits Hagar in the desert. Hagar is the first person in the Bible that such an angel visits, and this becomes the first in a series of firsts. The angel is also the first to name Hagar, recognizing her humanity. Hagar is also the first and only person that the angel talks to in the story. The angel does not address either Abram or Sarai. The angel tells Hagar to return to Sarai, which is problematic, since she may very well return to continued abuse at the hand of Sarai. Going back, however, also offers security, safety, and stability, things not available to her in the wilderness. After the angel tells Hagar to return, the angel promises Hagar that she will have innumerable descendants, echoing the promise to Abram. With this, Hagar becomes the first female in the Bible to receive such a promise. The angel then announces that Hagar will have a son, making Hagar the first woman in the Bible to receive an annunciation. The child's name is to be Ishmael, which means God hears, referring perhaps to God hearing and responding to Hagar's affliction. Soon after, Hagar realizes with whom she is speaking and names the Lord El-Roi, the God who sees. Hagar, whose own name was previously unspoken, becomes the only person in the Bible to name God. So what can we learn from these characters? Through a feminist reading and through the lens of trauma awareness, we can understand the pressures and trauma of living under a patriarchal system and how that motivated behavior. Being powerless and having her body used, like Hagar, being pressured by societal expectations of women, like Sarai, becoming paralyzed through witnessing and being complicit in the trauma of others, like Abram. In light of current movements like #MeToo, we can connect their stories to similar pressures in our own society. We can also hopefully see in these characters a model of resilience as they continue to move forward toward hope. And what can we learn of the divine, of how the divine is portrayed in this story? In light of current events such as those in Charlottesville and Durham, and the resurgence of white nationalism, and in light of political leadership that is unable to or unwilling to call out misogyny, racism, and xenophobia, we read in these texts of a God who cares for the foreigner, who honors the dignity and identity of the female slave, who sees the other, who responds to the cry of the afflicted. We also encounter a God who understands the danger of a single story and disrupts it. It's not a clean line from Abram to Isaac to Jacob and beyond. It's a complex and messed up story. But blessings and promises abound, eventually to Sarai, as we well know, who becomes Sarah, the mother of Isaac, the child of promise, but also to Hagar, the foreign slave, the mother of Ishmael.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.